Pushkin. Hi, I'm Phil Donahue.
And I'm Marlo Thomas. And we're going on a series of double dates to find out
what makes a marriage last. To meet Patricia Cornwell and Stacy Gruber, we only had to walk as far as the front door of our apartment. They had plans to be in Manhattan, so it saved us a trip to Boston.
Patricia, of course, is the world-famous crime novelist. More than 30 years ago, she turned murder and forensics into the hottest ticket in fiction. Now it's everywhere.
Stacy, no slouch herself, is a neuroscience researcher at Harvard's McLean Hospital and an associate professor of psychiatry. She's got bright red hair, and she had Patricia's attention from the get-go.
I literally almost never went home after meeting Stacy.
She spent two nights there.
Never went back.
With an instant attraction like that, we had to hear the whole story. So once we settled into our living room, they took us back to the beginning.
In 2003, my publisher, Phyllis Gran, who was at that time the head of Putnam, she took me out to dinner, and she said, "Okay, you started the forensic trend. What's the next trend?" And I said, "I don't know, but I want to be the one who does it." And so I started thinking, well, if you're not going to do forensics, that's going to be the brain. So I thought I'd maybe get more into the why of what people do and not so much the how and how you figure it out. And I thought, where would you go? You go to Harvard. And so through some contacts, I ended up at Stacy's hospital, and they were touring me around, and I wanted to know more
about... This is McLean's?
Yep, the brain and neuroscience and... And you were one of on the Dog and Pony Show.
I was.
And it was in her MR lab. And literally when she walked in the room, I felt like an electrical disturbance. I felt like the air moved.
Electrical disturbance.
And it wasn't
so
like, oh my God, she's so beautiful or anything like that.
It was not like that.
It was more like, there's something about this person. I have to know her. So at the end of the tour, I said to the PR person taking me around, I said, "I don't remember the name of that red-haired, you know, neuroscience person, but I have a few more questions for her. It's the oldest trick in the book."
Right.
I didn't know anything except that there was something about Stacy I have to know. This person, I cannot let her get away without me trying to get to know her.
Oh, how wild.
So, but that's my story.
Was it something she had said?
No, it was before she'd even said anything.
Right.
It was like her energy. I felt this energy that it got my attention. And it's very rare that happens with people.
Of course.
You know, and there's a connection. It doesn't mean you're going to date them, but it means you're going to do something
right,
or they're going to kill you. Something's going to happen.
Something. Now, how did you see it?
You know, so at McLean Hospital, we often have VIPs come through and philanthropists, all sorts of folks come through. Very often I'm asked to help out and sort of do these dog and pony shows. And, you know, I will never forget that day, actually, because I was very impressed with the questions that you asked. These were not the typical types of queries that most people make when they come. So that was the first thing that struck me. She was extraordinary, just in her ability to grasp things. And I remember finishing our interview, and I went back down to my office, and I was actually cleaning up to leave because I had plans that evening. And then I got a phone call from public affairs saying, "She has more questions. Do you have any more time?" And I'm looking, going, okay, how many more questions could she have? Sure, send her back. And so she did come back, and I think we talked for quite a while. And then there was the inevitable, you know, "Would you like to discuss this over dinner?" And for whatever reason, I don't know why, I thought to myself, yeah, I would.
But here's the funny part. She would not get in my limousine.
She had a big stretch limousine that, by the way, everybody in the hospital noticed. Everybody.
Oh, sure.
This was not the most unobtrusive thing, right? Everybody.
And why, did you not want to get into the car?
Well, I didn't know. Look, I'm a Jew from, you know, New York, New Jersey. We don't trust anybody.
That's funny.
So okay, I think that's terrific, but she's... No, I'm teasing. But I thought, you know, I should just go and meet her. I get in the car, I drive to her hotel, I pull up, and there she is. Like, I walked in, I was at the desk, I turned around, and there she was right behind this. Remember the big bowl of apples?
Yeah.
Right behind the apples, and I thought, there she is, just sitting and waiting. So, yeah.
We spent the next 3 days, every night we did something, and then the third one, we talked all night long.
Well, let's be honest. So that first night.
On the phone or in person?
In person. So that first night, I took her to dinner. We went to dinner. And we talked and talked and talked. And we had a very late evening.
Till about 3 a.m. Just talking in the car.
Just talking.
In front of her, in front of my hotel.
Yes,
because did you feel the chemical thing too?
There was certainly something there that was absolutely compelling, right? And there's this bizarre connection. You don't really want to stop talking, mm-hmm. Which I think is really rather magical. You just know there's just something.
Absolutely.
And she was very sweet and very kind. Said, "Let's go upstairs and chat." And I said, "No, we just kept driving around." Remember? We drove.
Suspicious little rat,
well,
isn't she?
Well, it's like a 16-year-old boy on a date. Doesn't even get to the front door.
So we drove around the circle of the hotel and talked and talked.
And when did you realize there was love here? I mean, or whatever.
I think for me, I think I knew by the time I was leaving there after staying up all night long, I knew this was something unusual, but I didn't really know how she felt. I thought she might just want to be friends, but whatever it is, we need to know each other.
Right.
And
but
so
you didn't discuss your sexual status.
I think we danced around a lot of that the first night.
For sure, the first night.
The second night was a little different in the intention question, but
then I think you get more of the questions where you were really getting to know each other, and so then you're going to start talking about your past relationships and all that sort of thing.
You were married, and you weren't.
No. Yeah, I'm an equal opportunity employer. I was married to a man, and now I'm married to a woman. I think it's just only fair.
I think so, too.
I don't want anybody to feel left out.
I know. What I think is interesting about the two of you is that you really are, mind and body. I mean, there you were in a morgue, and there you are with the mind. And I thought, what an interesting thing that you've...
This one right here, she's been to the morgue several times now. She'll go.
Many times.
And she'll stand in front of me. And it's like, I'm like, because I really don't like it. Don't tell anybody that. I hate the morgue, and I can't stand all that stuff, but I've had to do it for years.
To do it for your research.
Yes.
Right, let's be clear.
But she worked in a morgue.
But that's why I did it, to do the research.
And
I started out as a journalist.
Uh-huh.
The greatest profession.
Right.
Or used to be. Uh-huh. But I started out in journalism, then I did a biography, then I wanted to switch to fiction because I'd been a cop reporter. But I've always had a journalistic approach to what I do, which is why I met Stacy, because I go out and do the research. But she'll do anything.
Anything.
Well, how did you decide that that was the kind of story you wanted to tell? Was that
being
a cop reporter?
Yes, and I would get to the crime scene and they'd take the body away and I'd go, what are they doing with it? I want to know. Because I wanted to have a forensic pathologist. I wanted to have all that in there because no one had ever written about it beyond Quincy.
Oh, wow.
So I said, you got to immerse yourself. Huh. But all of it is, we're very compatible this way because it's what you call having a seeking mind. Like we can be driving somewhere and then I'm talking too much, it's your turn.
That's okay.
I do that anyway.
All good.
But we'll both look at something and say, I wonder how that got to, what happened to that? It looks that way.
We wonder. How come nobody else notices?
We wonder the same kinds of things.
Right.
Or we'll
kind of
look
curiosity.
At each other and we recognize the same thing that just passed us on a sidewalk and we're going,
did you see that?
You know.
Did you see that? But meanwhile, everybody else just walks past. They don't notice at all. And I don't understand that.
Do you help each other with your work?
Well, she certainly helps me with mine. We sit around and invent things, gadgets and stuff that go
We've
in
had
books.
A lot of fun over the years, that's
we
for
do
sure.
A lot of, she helps me with things that she's an expert in.
Well,
since I write about science.
And you certainly have helped me with what I do, for sure. I mean, my career has sort of taken a little bit of a different turn in the last few years.
In what way?
Being in neuroscience or in psychiatry more generally has shifted to having a very clear focus in the therapeutic strategies of exploiting cannabis or cannabinoids. So I spent a lot of time with medical cannabis patients. We started the only program in the country looking at the long-term effects of medical cannabis or cannabinoids for health benefits. But we have this one word, and we mean anything that comes from the plant, and I'm here to tell you that there are constituents from the plant that will never intoxicate you and have tremendous health benefits, but it's hard to study.
We use it on our backs.
That's tremendous.
The CBD, I think.
Yeah. Right. So I have the only study in the country that looks, it's a double-blind clinical trial to look at CBD, a high CBD, very low THC product for patients with anxiety, because my feeling is we can help people live better, more satisfying lives. So, in terms of being supportive, and being invested, and actually literally and figuratively invested.
I've given money to her project.
She certainly has.
And I'm very supportive of it because I've seen it. She comes home and I hear the stories about the patients and It's really a miraculous thing. And I'm also, it's really difficult when you work in something that can be so grossly misunderstood.
It's incredibly polarizing and stigmatized. I mean, people really have a very clear, sometimes incorrect idea of what it is. And this program has really skyrocketed, but it never would have been anything without Patricia's interest or investment and belief.
Did you have any, I don't know how the world is right now because, you know, I'm in show business where anything goes, so I have no idea. But when you were at McLean and you met a woman that you fell in love with, did they care about any of that? Did you have any obstacles there?
So, you know, I was pretty quiet, actually, about my life before that. And I, as an undergraduate, I went to music school and I went to a regular university. And it was pretty, at music school, anything went.
Right.
But I think at McLean, I had a pretty low profile in terms of my personal life.
Uh-huh.
That did change. People started to notice when this big stretched limousine started to spend time there.
Well, the first time I came to pick you up to go anywhere, the first time she let me actually pick her up was when I came back to bring her to New York the next week, and I picked you up in a helicopter. I'm a helicopter pilot, so.
Oh, you were flying the helicopter?
With the person that I was flying with, yeah.
So she says, well, I'll come get you in the helicopter. Well, this is like any average date. Sure, of course. Like every other person that picks me up, I'm thinking, oh, sure, that's fine.
Why do you fly a helicopter?
I got my license back in 1999 because my character Lucy was, I decided to make a helicopter pilot, and I love helicopters when I'd been flown in them for other things. So I decided to learn how. I just wanted to fly. I still do.
You know, you made a huge accommodation to move to Boston just to be with Stacy, right?
But I did kind of get rid of everything and move my whole life to Boston.
How long had you been together when you did that?
Oh, it started immediately. It started with me trying to find a place to stay up in Boston so I could work up there on a book and get to know Stacy better. But then very quickly we just looked and then we found a place and moved in together. I moved into your house while we were looking around. And
you were pretty positive.
You know, you just know what you feel.
Was that kind of scary?
Yes. I wouldn't say scary. I would say it was very unusual and a little, oh.
What about you? What accommodations did you make?
So I think looking back, you know, it was an unbelievable sort of whirlwind kind of thing that happened very quickly, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
Very, very quickly. And things all of a sudden were set into motion.
When I first went to Stacy's house, when we were just hardly starting to see each other, I went through and did a security check. And I had a burglar alarm put in. I had a privacy hedge. I had a gate. I mean, I did
at her house.
At her house. I mean, she hardly even knows me. No.
Why did you do that?
Because she was not living in a safe way. She was living in a beautiful place and had done really
well.
This is
what happens when you live with a crime writer.
I had just finished redoing that house, and we were just considering this security system, and that
How did that make you feel when she did that?
You know, it was an unusual thing to have someone come in and say, look, you know, here's what you need to have, this. And I thought, okay,
furthermore,
easy.
I'm paying for it and we're doing it now.
And then I had to deal with somebody that worked for her. And I said, actually, we're not doing it that way. You can pay for this. I'm paying for this. We're not going to do it this way. It worked out okay.
But I think it's so funny that you, of all people, I mean, you're known for being this fantastic crime writer. She knows every crime that can happen.
I do. And I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen to us as best I can.
We'll have more after a quick break. We're back to our conversation with Patricia Cornwell and Stacy Gruber. When we left off, Stacy was describing what it's like when a famous crime writer moves in.
My way of life, the way of life that I knew previously was, I would say, gone. It's gone. No, that's over.
Listen, she went from driving her own car, living in her own house, having no alarm system, just living like a normal person, to living on a place where you have armed guard, living on the premises. And not because I'm kooky, but because I've had issues in the past, and I'll be darned if anybody's going to bug us, you know, or come up there. But I mean, it's kind of like the way a lot of people live in Los Angeles, where you've got to be careful.
But because
there was
so much,
because we're on this
big property, right? So she has firearms. I had to get licensed to carry a firearm. I had to learn to ride a motorcycle. I did all sorts of things, right? These are not necessarily.
We weren't running around with guns on us, though. They were locked in. We're not like gun crazy people.
No, not gun crazy people.
But you also inherited a life a person who drew attention in ways that had not before.
That's right.
So everything about your day-to-day life,
everything about your day-to-day life changes. Everything. Right. Your profile is completely different.
And I had people before who couldn't put up with that. They thought they could put up with it, and then when it really got going, it threatened their sense of autonomy and power, and then you're going, you know, you're really having issues. And so you put up a lot. You still do.
So what made you decide to get married?
You
go ahead.
What was the distance between the legality of marriage and...
Year and a half.
May of 2004, I think it became legal.
So we
got married...
2006.
February 2006, we got married. We met in July of 2004.
I just told her we were getting married. There was no asking.
I said, is there something I don't know?
I said, I want to get married. I want to make this legal. I mean, I said, this is not a romantic question. It's a legal question. It's a contract thing. I think we should do this.
Happy you didn't say it was a romantic thing.
That's what I said.
And I said, well, just go do a JP in Provincetown and do it.
Actually, what she said was, as she called my office, can you just get that set up? And can you just get that set up? You know, sort of like dinner reservations or maybe a flight. Sure, I can get that set up.
I don't know how to do any of that. I'd been married before, and it was the big thing. It was the dress and the bridesmaids, and it was the church
and
300
intact.
People or whatever. I don't want any of that again. This is different. I said, I just want us to be together. Let's just go make it
this
so
weekend.
That we
let's
are.
Just get married and get that done. Can we get that done?
I just had made a decision that this was it. This is who I want to spend my life with. And furthermore, I didn't tell my lawyers, and there was no prenup.
It makes your commitment all the more
meaningful.
Real.
When we were about to get married, both of our business managers said you should get prenups. And we both said, that's kind of betting against ourselves. We're not going to do that.
There might be a disparity in what I earn and what she earns. But the value that she's added to my life, including economically, because you're smart with money and I'm not, I would never want to quibble about something anyway.
We didn't tell anybody. We actually went and did it.
We eloped.
which turns out to be a Gruber family tradition. My mother eloped, and my grandmother and grandfather, may they rest in peace, eloped. Some people were disappointed not to have been involved.
But I have
to tell you, I am not that unhappy about it, because it turns out I didn't think I would ever be married either. I just didn't. And taking these vows, I felt surprisingly emotional for some reason. It just sort of snuck up.
Well, of course you would.
But I didn't expect it.
I sobbed all through our wedding, and I was the one who never wanted to be married.
But I didn't expect that. And I think it was because of this approach that we both sort of had, you know, let's get it done, let's get it this. All of a sudden, it sort of hit me what it meant. And I think that I won't ever forget that. It was one of those things that things don't often sneak up behind me and whap me right over the head, but that did. And I didn't. And I thought, oh, thank God no one else is here, because I almost just cried just now. So I don't know how you felt, but that's certainly how I felt. It felt very emotional.
Well, it was a big deal, because I'd been married once before. And the thing is, if you've had a traditional marriage first, and by the way, the first time I got married, I thought that was going to last forever. I mean, I didn't do it because I thought I should. I was only he'd been my professor since I was 19 years old. And so, but the thing is, to me, it was the opposite thing. I thought it is a big deal, because I have done it before, and it is a big deal, and it's important. But what I don't care about is what I didn't care about and wouldn't today is all the ceremony involved.
No.
And all the hoopla. I don't care about that at all.
We have zero hoopla.
Yeah, we sure did.
We were hoopla free.
I love that they were no fuss about it. With Patricia's Rolodex, they could have had all kinds of famous people at their wedding.
Including Barbara and George Bush. Remember? They'd spent a memorable weekend with the Bushes at Kennebunkport.
And Barbara put us in separate bedrooms in the guest house. And she said, don't you even think about visiting.
However, they have other guests visiting. A couple who had a third with them, a gentleman who had his arm in a cast. A lovely guy from MIT with a broken arm. His room connected to my room through a bathroom. That was the comment. So that was all right.
So if he went out in the wrong door, he could have climbed into bed with Stacy.
Let me tell it. So what does she do? So she says, well, we can't sleep in the same room, but this is okay. So she goes, I'm just going to tell. They're both
Who's
gone.
Who's she?
Patricia. both the Bushes, may they rest in peace, are gone. She goes and she gets a chair and she puts it on the inside of the door of the bathroom. So this poor schmuck can't get into the bathroom from his bedroom. He's got to go into the hallway.
Like, I'm sorry, what
she says,
anybody end
no
up in your
way.
Room?
Because he's going to come through. He's going right in that bedroom. Now, don't think she's controlling her. Just don't misread it.
Wouldn't be.
She's definitely Sicilian. I've known
he
that.
He didn't mean
beginning.
To on purpose, but he might have. And I wasn't going to have that. I was going to be awake all night worrying about it.
We did think it was very funny that we were separated, but some dude, I never met this guy. It's okay for me to be with him. That's cool.
I can't imagine that she wouldn't want two women to share a bathroom. Rather than a man.
She didn't want two women to share in anything.
Oh, God. My mother would have done the same thing.
But it speaks to their confidence in who they are, that they can laugh at it.
My mother's closest friend when I was a kid happened to be gay. And I didn't necessarily think there was anything wrong or bad about it at all. I was raised to believe that all sorts of things were perfectly fine, no matter what color you were or what your sexual orientation was. It didn't necessarily matter. Until it's you. And then it's a little different, if you know what I mean.
So tell us.
I think it's a little different, perhaps, and this is only on me. I can never speak for anybody else. I think that I always felt that I perhaps had been a bit of a disappointment because that wasn't necessarily a traditional trajectory that I was going to follow. Uh-huh. I dated plenty of boys. I never had any trouble in that department, but clearly that wasn't going
to
be.
A disappointment to who, your parents?
I think that I worried that that would somehow disappoint my family. I do. I think that was, because it's very hard.
In the town I grew up in, which I wasn't, not Catholic, but the Billy Grahamville, because it was that little town. If you're a woman in your 40s and you're still not married, then you go into what's called the spinster category.
Right.
And said spinsters usually lived together, and they probably weren't, quote, spinsters after all.
Right, right, right.
The gym teacher phenomenon. Right.
All those gym teachers were always so close.
Were they?
How close were they?
They were cousins. That was another one they used to
use. By the way,
a Billy Grahamville was Montreat, wasn't
yeah.
it?
That's where I, from age of 7 until I went off to college, that's where I lived, right down the road from them.
Yeah.
Because my mother had moved us there when her marriage split up.
So if you felt that you were a lesbian, that wouldn't be the town to come out in, would it?
No, but I didn't know what I was. I mean, nobody talked about anything in that town. You couldn't even have cooking sherry in the house. Nobody talked about sex. I mean,
cooking sherry.
No, you couldn't. It was, they were that strict. Huh. You know, you didn't cuss. I mean, you didn't do anything. There was no... So this would, in fact, a lot of those same people, they would, you know, if I got struck by lightning, which could really happen some of the places I go, I'd tell God, don't do that, because too many people would say, of course.
Oh, that's
of course
right.
She was.
That's right.
When I was growing up, the two worst things you could be, if you were an alcoholic or gay, was like really bad. And I drink too much and oh, well, that's the rest of the story. But,
what did your ex-husband feel about all of a sudden you're liking women? Was that a shock?
Oh, he'd heard about that before. It had been in the news for years.
Oh, uh-huh.
And, his first comment was, I didn't make you this way, did I? I said, you don't have that power. You know,
people often
that's such
that.
A male thing.
You know, after
I mean, oh God, that's hilarious.
You know, we're friends, we're great friends, but you know, he was concerned. I said, because we'd broken up, and I say, no, not even you have that power. I'm sorry.
Oh, do you have any particular advice for other same-sex partners?
I would say that remember that the hardest thing is getting over shame, because most people a lot of people like me grow up where this is absolutely verboten and you're something wrong with you. You didn't have as much of that because you didn't grow up in the South. But I would say that to remember that shame is something that is inflicted on you by the outside. It is not real. Be comfortable with yourself. And that's a big one, because if you're not comfortable with yourself, I think you're not going to have something that's going to work very well, don't
that's
you think?
That's right. That's exactly right.
But you got to deal with those things. If you grew up with something where this wasn't mainstream, and most people do grow up with that, I would advise you, make sure both of you are dealing with that, because it's real.
And don't let others judge you by their metric. Don't be judged by someone else's metric. It does not apply to you.
The most important thing in the relationship is that you both should make each other better at what you're here to do and who you are. And she is always my go-to person, and she's my biggest supporter, and I try to be that for her with what she does. And because I think, you know, feelings are fun and they're easy, but making things work and trying to be unselfish and to take care of somebody and to allow yourself to be taken care of and realize that together you're better than you are than if you're apart, that to me is what it's about.
That's Patricia Cornwell and Stacy Gruber. What a smart and interesting couple.
Their work is so different, but they somehow make them dovetail quite nicely.
Just like two other people I know. Until next time, I'm Phil Donahue.
And I'm Marlo Thomas.
I think that's one of the magical things about being in a relationship is if you can celebrate what the other person does and who they are.
You know, if I had to put my money on this one, I'd bet on you guys. I would.
Double Date is a production of Pushkin Industries.
The show was created by us and produced by Sarah Lilly. Michael Bahari is associate producer. Musical adaptations of It Had to Be You by Stellwagen Symphonette.
Marlo and I are executive producers, along with Mia Lobel and Lital Molad from Pushkin.
Special thanks to Jacob Weisberg, Malcolm Gladwell, Heather Fain, John Schnars, Carly Migliori, Eric Sandler, Emily Rostek, Jason Gambrell, Paul Williams, and Bruce Kluger.
If you like our show, please remember to share, rate, and review. Thanks for listening.